Today I want to continue with the topic relationships. This is the second part of this discussion. It seems as if our relationship with our Creator shows up clearly in all other relationships, those with our parents, those with siblings, those with people outside of our family. And in fact, those people can become representatives of the Creator, and that is a common misunderstanding. We know that we can be warm and loving and encouraging and realize that love is the truth of all relationships. Those are the kind of thought processes that we would have at this age in our lives. Or we can believe, like many of us did when we were children, that scarcity and punishment, favoritism, judgment, and worse were part of the relationship with our Creator and also authority figures. We can believe that we have the freedom to express our unique talents, or if our training is such that we learn that there's an absolute necessity to obey rules that have been created by men but attributed to God. That's a kind of religious overtone to a lot of things that go on in American families and perhaps families around the world. So this brings me to the next area of relationships, how our egos use our individual personalities to meet its four driving needs. And I'm thinking that the degree to which we're committed to meeting these driving needs are indicators of, one, how much we are ego-controlled, two, how little we trust in our Creator to provide the truth of existence that are described very clearly and powerfully in letter number one of Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Three, it's an indication of how five senses oriented we are. That is, how much we rely and accept only things based upon the appearance or the material reality, the things that we can see, touch, taste, and feel, and how much we desire those sorts of things. In other words, how materialistic we are. The fourth is how little we appreciate the reality of our interconnectedness with all of life, not just other human beings, but animals, including those that find their way to our plates, as well as the water, the world, the air, the soil, entire Mother Earth. And then finally, one of the great indicators is how much we think of ourselves and about ourselves as compared to others. We think of ourselves over others way more frequently than them, and there's no balance there. Since energy acquisition is essential to life, if we didn't do that, we wouldn't exist. So we will acquire energy. So now the question becomes, what are the real variables? The real variables are the forms of energy that we seek to acquire and the forms that we will seek to avoid. In other words, if you look at your life, we all have clear relationships with the energy. It's just that we have to become more aware, we're more mindful of the nature of those relationships. And if we recognize that those things are not really taking us in the direction that we want to go, then we can upgrade them. It should be easy to recognize how we feel about some of the most obvious energy forms that we encounter as human beings. I'm going to say these things slowly and see if you can notice in your own body a reaction about how you feel about food, clothing, shelter, education, books, reading, eating, sleeping, moving the body, money, attention, feelings of pride of achievement, feelings of self-protection and defensiveness, and there are many more, but you should have been able to feel something happening as those words came to your ears. You're like, because they have consciousness, and your consciousness, your field of energy, is going to react to these environmental signals that I just sent you by way of my voice. You're like, I got a hit on that one. You can take a look at that. I use another list of needs when I do some consideration and journaling and coaching and thinking, for that matter. These are in addition to the four driving needs described in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. And this list is easy to remember. I refer to it as Sfuli plus two. S-F-U-L-I plus two. And that stands for survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, and the need to look good or get approval. When we think of that, you can notice this going on for some people, and you can recognize that in our backgrounds, our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were oftentimes in the survival mode. You know, they weren't thinking so much about love and identity. They're just trying to survive, because that's the first order of business, survival. When there's energy enough to satisfy those needs, then things are a lot easier. But when the energy that's available is scarce, it decreases, and we perceive it's going down to dangerous levels, we're going to make efforts to increase that energy. We're going to try to acquire it from somewhere, somehow. Now, our perceptions of what energies we need to survive, to be free, to be useful, to be loved, to sustain our sense of self, that's our identity, which is ever-changing over the courses of our lives, to be right, to look good and get approval, those things are going to govern us depending on our personal backgrounds. If any of those needs were chronically threatened when we were kids, we're going to tend to react in, I'll just say, one of three ways. There may be more ways. But conveniently, number one is to consistently attempt to fill this need. Get more, get more, get more, get more, get more, get more. Number two is to deny the importance to us and then work to dampen that internal urge to acquire it. Oh, no, I don't really want money. No, I don't really want attention. Oh, no, I don't need happiness, right? Whatever it is, we're trying to put the brakes on that urge, because we have some sort of belief that it's too difficult. We lack the necessary talent to achieve our goals energetically. And the third area is to succumb to the feeling that we can never have the energy we need. And so we depress ourselves to try not to feel the loss, the pain related to that, or the urge to acquire it. And you go, yikes. You can look around and see the common forms of energy that people use in those three contexts. Even medications and supplements are really popular forms of energy. Oh, you must have this, you must have that. And you can read about that every day, all day. One more pill, one more chemical, one more substance, one more product that we need in order to be healthy, happy, successful, you name it. But the trouble is, when we make our happiness or our health contingent upon the acquisition of a specific energy pattern, particularly in material form, we would have given our power away. You've heard this maybe even in your own mind, but you're certainly from other people. As soon as I get, fill in the blank, I'm going to be happy, or I'm going to be successful, or I'm going to be peaceful, or I'm going to be relaxed, or I'm going to be healthy, on and on. That's a trick, and it's a trap. And oftentimes, it's a step in the direction of addiction. We give power to that other thing. I used to hear this all the time. Bright guys in corporate America. Why do you smoke? Oh, I like to. It helps me think better. It relaxes me. Are you sure? And kind of like a political belief, you know, that people that were really addicted to nicotine, not open to you trying to take that energy form away from them. You're going to do what? No way. And they would justify the use of that, saying it was absolutely necessary and it was a good idea because it helped them to think better. I'm guessing that the cells in the body getting smoke filled with tar and nicotine probably are not as happy as cells getting fresh air. I'm just thinking that might be true. But if we have any, I'll say, X energy pattern, that if I have that, I'll be happy. If I have that, I'll be successful. If I have that, I'll be wonderful. That stuff that controls our happiness or covers up our unhappiness puts us in a really difficult place. Very easy to know that a person is not or shouldn't be, or we would think, not necessarily happy because he has or doesn't have a pack of cigarettes available to him. But if they believe that I can't be happy without it, even though it's false, you and I would recognize it as false and that certain times they would as well. But by reinforcing that belief and accepting it and giving power to it, they can make it true. They can turn a false statement into something that is true and controlling for themselves. I'm guessing that one of the steps in Alcoholic Anonymous 12-step program that talks about reliance on one's own God in order to overcome the addiction is really the idea of shifting the reliance away from this material substance, alcohol, to a divine power, a power that is way more powerful than alcohol or us as individuals or anything else. Seems clear, although you can't tell this by looking at an alcoholic's behavior, that alcohol as an energy pattern has produced very little empowerment and enhancement in the lives of the consumer. And it's easy to know, if you've spoken to people who've been drinking, that use of alcohol can distort and lower the person's consciousness. And, you know, all of a sudden, their view of reality has changed tremendously. Then, all of a sudden, they're expressing these driving needs in a completely different way. People that were milquetoast turn into, you know, barroom brawlers, and then the next day have no recollection of it. It's like, yikes, yikes. When it comes to relationships, I think if we're not investing ourselves, if we're not putting our energy and our time and our thoughts and our feelings into understanding and experiencing our source of being, you know, the same invisible power, invisible to the naked eye, but you can certainly see the effects of this power, that same power, that same source that enabled us to be created, that same source that's now enabling our healing and thriving. It's like, if we don't invest in that, we're going to be like a chicken in that just had its head cut off and is allowed to run in the farmyard until it bleeds out. Or, if you can't get into that gruesome thing, that's a hometown image that I had, because a guy in my backyard, the neighbor, had chickens, and I remember seeing that once or twice, and not a pleasant sight. It's unbelievably fascinating that that could occur, but not pleasant. So let's choose hamster on the treadmill. If we're not investing in our relationship with our Creator, we're like a hamster on a treadmill. We can be working hard, doing, but not really making much forward progress. I think if we can know that we're related to God consciousness, call it divine consciousness, universal consciousness, Christ consciousness, and it's like, wait a minute, if everything is consciousness, everything has come out of universal consciousness and then into divine consciousness, which is starting to manifest, well, hey, that means you and I are extensions of that consciousness. And we can become more conscious. We can change for the better. We can change every relationship that we've had in the past, and we can change every relationship that we have from that moment where we recognize that we are a projection of the same consciousness that creates worlds. Like, wow, if we can go back in time with our consciousness and change all the relationships, all the activities that we've ever had, all the energy exchanges, all the mistakes, all the trial and error that we ever went through, and see it differently, that would be wonderful. All relationships would change when we see with eyes of love. We're actually looking at something with the idea that we're going to connect with it, bond with it, respect it, appreciate it. And we'll do the same thing when we speak with a voice of love or hear with the ears of love, because it's the same thing that's coming at us. That environmental signal being spoken by somebody else is their attempt to express their uniqueness. Well, is it going to be exactly like our attempt to express our uniqueness? Probably not. But part of love is to be able to respect that different form of expression. You look around, you go, very little of what I see is actually like me. Curtains and walls and floors and ceilings and this and that are not exactly like me. All are forms of consciousness shaped differently. And when we know that, with thoughts of love, we can start to relax a little bit more. All relationships will have energy preservation as an underlying factor. Now, the degree to which energy preservation affects a relationship is going to vary according to the degree that threats are perceived. You know that fingernail on the blackboard image that I use periodically? It's like, our bodies react to that without thought. That's not a, let me think, I don't like that sound. That's not what happens. The cells of the body, the nerves, react to that unpleasant sound and go into energy preservation, trying to protect themselves from that disharmony. It's normal. It's natural. It's what's happening all the time. And you could see people doing all kinds of things because of this, I got to protect, I've got to preserve, I got to hold on to my energy because I perceive some sort of threat. If you think about fight or flight, you go, fight or flight, yep, I know that's a natural reaction, but that is a response to circumstances. And if you look at it and go, wait a minute, if we perceive a threat is something that's trying to acquire our energy, you know, saber-toothed tiger, bill collector, car coming at us, it's going to do something damaging to my energy. If we can perceive that, we can defeat that energy with our own energy. We can dominate or overwhelm or control or manage it. We're going to choose to fight. We're going to hold our ground and fight. On the other hand, flight is going to be chosen when we look at that threat and go, no way, I'm not going to be able to fight this. I'm not going to be able to control this. This is way bigger than me. And our instinctive reaction is going to be to get out of there, to leave, because of our perception that our energy, our consciousness, all the resources we have available to us are no match for the threat. When somebody finds fault with us, what is that? What is that? Well, we can process it. It's a signal, of course. It's a signal. And somebody used words. That's a fact. But we can process it as a threat to our energy. Or we could take that energy as a constructive and supportive input and go, that's going to help me be more effective. It's going to help me avoid a particular energy loss in the future. Lots of negative energy tools, if you will, or weapons, are used in relationships, and they're geared to belittle another person. Think of that. We belittle others with our thoughts, feelings, words, and actions. We try to make them little. You know why? So they don't and they can't threaten us. Then they won't be able to take our energy because we made them little. It's like, politically, economically, militarily, you can see so many examples of this energy preservation. Rulers in power, how about Syria right now? Resist rebellious groups. Why? The rebellious groups want more energy. They want more power. They want more influence. They want more money. And so now you've got this battle going on. Corporations with large market share and political clout, they're going to resist having their behaviors or their profits curtailed by competition or legislation. We're going to continue doing this. People fight over boundaries frequently. And by that, I'm not saying just the boundary is the edge of a piece of property, of real estate. I'm talking about boundaries that are, related to our physical space. Some people can have people stand really, really close to them. Other people go, no. Could you move away? You're standing so close to me. You know, your nose is almost touching my nose as you're talking to me. You can see that stuff in cultures. It's interesting. Some people require more space and some less space. Our values, we have boundaries to that, to our viewpoints, to our beliefs, to our prejudices, to our opinions, to the religious tenets that we accept. We don't know these are true and these I hold them dear. This is the reason why people say when you go to a cocktail party, do not discuss religion and do not discuss politics. Because political beliefs and even social beliefs about how people should behave and how they do behave are boundaries that we have. And when we clash with other people's boundaries, we got challenged. How about this idea? When we are rubbed the wrong way, that's another way of saying we perceive that one of our boundaries or another is being encroached upon, being threatened, and we react to protect it. How? With fight or flight. We move away from those people, or we intensify our own emotions and get in their face, if you will, and then it becomes a conflict. And if you notice defensiveness in yourself or other people, consider that you are witnessing energy preservation in action. I think you can say the degree of our defensiveness is tied to the degree of our perceived vulnerability. If we weren't vulnerable, it's like, what threat? I don't perceive a threat. But if we believe we can't protect ourselves or our territories, spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, are being threatened, we're going to be more anxious. There clearly will be times when we're not able to preserve our energy. We're going to be hurt by these encounters. We're going to have energy exchanges where we feel as though we lost energy. Licking our wounds, that's a phrase, licking our wounds in solitude is a natural reaction. I would say those times are times of repair and self-maintenance, you go, and we can use it as an opportunity to increase our awareness. What just happened? Why did it happen? Let me understand this. What were the factors involved in what just occurred? Then we can develop more effective rules that can serve us in the future, in our next encounter with whatever it was, an animal, a person, piece of equipment, or whatever. In order to do that, in order to make that time of solitude and self-repair effective, we're going to have to overcome some human tendencies. Human tendencies, what's that? The urge to self-pity and the urge to make somebody else wrong so we can be right. That need to be right, you know, Sapuli plus two, and that's the first of the plus two. The need to be right is unbelievably powerful in human beings. Wars start over that. Families end over that. Murders occur because of that. Human beings and need to be right. Hatfield and McCoy, feud. The need to be right. That you find yourself going in that direction, you're going to pay. You'd certainly want to pay particular attention and put the brakes on. I would say that self-pity, because it's a natural thing, is kind of a taking care of your own wound, and it does have a hint of self-care. But any extended period of time, you're going to find out it's not really an effective way of expanding one's own empowerment. Wrongmaking holds us in a place of being right. Yeah, I just made the other person right, I'm wrong, so I'm right. And the trouble is, then we don't need, or at least we tell ourselves, we don't need any more understanding that we than we have at that moment. Because I'm right, period, end of story, and we shut down. Worse yet, wrongmaking is sowing, and the harvest is being made wrong, either by ourselves or others. We don't want to set that in motion. That's not an effect that we want to cause. If we tend to our wound, you know, the hurt we're feeling, and we can identify the facts of it without going into a whole big story, and well, it means this and it means that. You look at the facts of the story and don't go into the story that we make up, and then reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness, asking for enlightenment. Like, what is the highest possible viewpoint available to me when I look at this situation? What is that? When we fish for that higher viewpoint, that higher level of awareness, and we succeed at hearing it and letting it penetrate our human consciousness, we can heal faster. And we can have our energy renewed for the next re-engagement with life. We're constantly going to be exchanging our energy with other people, things, processes, concepts. And if we treat them as if they're hot stoves, we're going to find ourselves unable to engage with them. So it needs to be healed. The energy translation phase of my energy model of life is related exactly to the meanings we make up and associate with our energy exchange experiences. The translation of an environmental signal, you know, something we see, something we hear, something we feel, something we smell, taste, or touch. You got to recognize that that is one of the most creative activities of the human mind. It's unbelievable the range of things that we can make up about an environmental signal. How about this? We can make a noise scary or intriguing. One, we want to run away, and the other, we want to investigate. Oh, that's interesting. I want to see what that's about. We can make a shadow terrifying or amusing. And it goes on and on. So what is that activity based upon? It's based upon that activity. I mean, our energy translation habits is based upon our consciousness. What is that again? It's the sum total of all of our energy exchange experiences, at least in this lifetime, if not other times. And that incredible mass of information, of energy patterns, consider it some sort of an inventory that is available to us all the time. And so when we take an environmental signal coming in the next 5 minutes, for instance, we will compare it to something we've previously acquired. It's already in our inventory. Do I have it in the friend or foe category? Do I have it in the bond with or reject it category? Do I have it in the I like it or I don't like it categories? And we do this, and we do it so fast, most people are unaware that comparing process even goes on. You go, you would be able to understand. It's pretty easy, actually, to imagine a person with an inventory chocked full of abuse, hateful experiences, unhappiness, is going to be more oriented to perceiving threats when they process incoming environmental signals. Why? Because they're going to look to, here comes a signal. Let me hold on a second while I compare it to my inventory. My inventory consists of gazillions of negative experience. Yep, this kind of looks like, boom, we're going to be defensive or go into fight or flight. For our purposes, we recognize that one of the great hopes of modern energy medicine, and I think this was probably the whole point of the psychology too, starting with Freud or maybe some other people earlier, and certainly people since him, that to be able to effectively help a person retranslate past events. If we can retranslate an event and see it in a different context, make it safe so that we can access different points of view about it, so that those different points of view at the minimum are less threatening and ideally life-enhancing translations. Now you go, oh, wow, I thought that would put a hole in my balloon, but in fact, it was strengthening. It helped me in this way and that way. Personally, I believe we have that ability in every single case to be able to retranslate an event, get a new point of view on it, and make it empowering, make it strengthening, make it developmental, educational, and growthful. Like, wow, every single time, I believe that to be true. Living life based upon the translation of energy by a 5-year-old kid when you were 5 or I was 5, and we use, I translate, this is what this means, and then I'm going to create a rule of life, and that's not a good idea. We don't want to be living our lives based upon the rules that we created when we were a 5-year-old child. Like, yeah, that might not be a good idea. That 5-year-old wasn't really fully aware, didn't develop its awareness, didn't fully grasp everything that was going on, was thinking almost entirely of self, and most likely was in the presence of people who were malfunctioning physically, mentally, or emotionally. So like, not a good time to make up life rules. But we recognize that things and circumstances change. We recognize that today. And if we can go, you know what? The past is not actually past. I can change my impressions, my interpretations, my translations of those past events, and I can heal them. Because if they're still threats, you and I will be resisting them, either by fighting them or avoiding them. And if I'm not going to look at that, no, I'm not going to think about that, no, I'm not going to talk about that, no, I'm not going to deal with that, that's a form of flight. That's a form of flight. And it'd be wonderful if everything disappeared, but those energy patterns are still there in our field, draining our energies. And we can do something about it. And that is how we would improve our relationship with ourselves and everybody else. Because when we stop resisting because we've reduced the threat energy in our inventory, we are going to embrace life, including people and opportunities and challenges, far more. I would like to end the service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8. Christ returns, reveals startling truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.